hailing frequencies are open. Welcome to the Infinite Potato Alliance.
Welcome to That Star Trek Podcast.
I am the Guardian of Forever.
This is your place for detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek.
Double dumbass on you!
Join us as we dive into the newest content coming available, as well as retrospectives of the past series and films.
All out, abandon ship!
Now, on with the show.
I'll see you in 500 years,
and I'll see you in a few minutes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to That Star Trek Podcast, your place for a detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek. My name is Sean Ray, and I once watched TNG episode Darmok and thought nobody would communicate that way until I saw a text stream from my kids to their friends, and it's all memes and emojis. Joining me tonight in the historic Infinite Potato Studios, we have Rick. How's it going, sir?
It is a warrior's drink.
Diet Coke. And Jen is here as well. How are you?
Live long and prosper. Hi, folks.
And rounding out the panel is Scott.
I'm surprised you had me back after the pacing you gave me on Archer 4.
So tonight we are continuing our retrospective of Star Trek's time travel episodes. This week, we're taking a look at the 15th episode of TNG's third season, which was titled Yesterday's Enterprise, written by Richard Manning, Hans Beimler, Ira Stephen Baer, and Ronald D. Moore, directed by David Carson, original air date February 17th, 1990. The Enterprise C enters the Enterprise D's time and space continuum, where they find Picard and crew in a constant state of war with Klingons, and only Guinan knows it. All right, so let's do what we normally do and kind of go around the virtual table and everybody kind of give an overall thought of what you felt about this episode. I'll start with Jen.
Oh, I get to go first this time?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, well, in my opinion, this is probably one of the best Tasha episodes of the entire series. It's finally we get to see Denise back after she left, you know, near the end of first season for reasons that we've all delved into before. We don't need to go into it again, but it was nice to have her back, even if it was an alternate timeline kind of situation. And the fact that her and Guinan were together, considering they missed out on each other in the original timeline, was interesting. And then the overall idea of the show in this particular episode, and the fact that it had repercussions in later episodes, I think is just really, really interesting, but we'll discuss that.
Okay. All right. Scott, what about you?
This episode consistently ranks somewhere in the top five, sometimes depending on the day, even the top three of my favorite TNG episodes of the entire series. There's very little about this particular episode that I find lacking or off the mark. This is a fine example of a Next Generation episode firing on all cylinders, and one of the banner headline reasons that season three is arguably their best season.
Yeah. Okay. Rick,
this is one of my top five. Yeah. This is one of my top five favorite episodes of all of Trek. The exact arrangement is fluid, but I love this episode there, and I just rewatched it tonight. I don't need an excuse to rewatch it. This is one of my, like, you know, everybody has that episode that they go to, or a handful of episodes that when they just need to cheer up, they go back and watch it. And this Redemption and like Devil in the Dark are like, you know, my three. I just love this episode so much. Yes, we will talk about the later repercussions of it, which I don't like quite so much. but I know some people Bill Smith of the Trek Geeks find that the repercussions are too much for him, and it retroactively ruined the episode for him, which is a shame. I think this episode is solid as a rock. Every performance is fantastic. There is not a single moment in this episode that I don't absolutely love.
I don't think, I don't think you can retroactively ruin an episode. I mean, the episode is either good or it's bad. Now, stuff that that writers and people do later, that doesn't change the fact that it was a good episode. But
Alien 3.
That doesn't make the first Alien movie a bad movie.
Mm-hmm. Not the first one, but it utterly destroys the triumph of Aliens.
It's like Highlander 2 is a terrible movie, but it doesn't ruin Highlander.
I can still
enjoy the first movie and just pretend like the second one doesn't exist.
Because it doesn't exist. That's
the hypothetical second Highlander movie doesn't negate anything from the first movie.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, totally, but
not in a meaningful way.
Well, it defines things that didn't need to be defined.
Exactly. It was just stupid and it was easy to ignore. But like, you know, the first 5 minutes of Alien 3 utterly craps all over the victory of the end of Aliens.
And maybe
I'm not
going to
say why, because that's maybe a spoiler, but...
But if you go back and watch Aliens, if you go back and watch Aliens, then that movie doesn't somehow magically end with their victory being undone. It ends with their victory and then the credits. And if you choose at the end of the movie when the credits are rolling to say, and then after this, we get what happens in Alien 3. Well, that's a person doing it to themselves.
It's not a choice, though. It's like, I know what's coming up, and it pisses me off.
I understand. I understand what you're saying. I'm just saying that that one piece of art is either good or bad. It doesn't, another piece of art doesn't ruin it. This is all opinions.
Your mileage may vary.
Yeah.
The point I was making is that while I don't really care for the Sela storyline, to put a finer point on it, it wasn't bad enough to have a negative effect for me on the Yesterday's Enterprise.
Yeah.
But I know people who it did.
Mm-hmm.
That was the point I was making.
This is a really, really good episode of Star Trek, but I'm the guy that looks at the time travel, and I'm like, it doesn't really work the way that they're saying it's going to work. We're going to talk about it, because the first line of this podcast is your place for detailed analysis and speculation. Of all things Trek, so I'm going to talk about what I find wrong with the time travel in this episode. But that being said, I still love this episode, and I did think that Denise Crosby did a good job in this episode. I know Tom sent me a message earlier; he was supposed to be here tonight and couldn't make it, but he has other thoughts. He didn't really think Denise Crosby did that great of a job, but I do wonder. And we'll get into all this. This is supposed to be a battleship. Why do they need a bartender?
I'm still of the opinion that, yes, it is still Guinan. Yes, she is dressed similarly to the way she is dressed in the unaffected timeline. But there's nothing to say that she's necessarily a bartender rather than just the head of the galley.
Well, yeah. At least they did change the fact that they didn't need a counselor, so Troy's not there, and obviously since they're still at war with the Klingons, Worf is not there. They did have those details in there.
Can I just say, as the only former military member of this quatrain here, the military runs on two liquids. Gasoline and alcohol.
I was going to say caffeine.
Sure as hell needs a bar.
Did you notice?
May need one, but do they have one?
They should, yeah.
You say they should, but modern battleships don't have a bar or a bartender. And regardless,
but an aircraft carrier does.
Oh well, there. Okay, then. Then.
And the Enterprise is more equivalent of an aircraft carrier than a battleship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was one thing. I understand that this was an early 90s episode of a TV show, so obviously they're not going to make a lot of changes to the ship and stuff, but the way the Enterprise is designed is not really... It can do battle, but if it was designed to be a battleship, it probably wouldn't look like that.
Yeah,
it wouldn't have a huge saucer section and all that kind of stuff. Yeah,
I've never understood, and this goes back to, you know, Rick, you and I are basically of the same mind that we don't necessarily love the shape of a Galaxy class starship. So I've never really understood why, in addition to it being the biggest and most advanced ship in the fleet when it first hits space, and it's the flagship, but multiple times throughout the series, there is mention made of how tough a Galaxy class starship is and how formidable it is in battle.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. I don't know what makes it so formidable. It looks...
It's got a shitload of phasers on it.
It looks sluggish. It looks awkward. It has a whole bunch of wide open flat surface area for enemies to fire upon. The geometry of it, you know, gives a lot of targets, and just never looked all that fierce or impressive when it comes to a firefight, as opposed to, say, the Defiant.
Well, if the Enterprise goes into a battle, they didn't do it a lot of times, but it's designed so that they can separate the saucer section and then go into battle. And then the Enterprise without the saucer section is more maneuverable and everything, and can do battle a lot better. But now you've got a battleship that still has this huge saucer section on it.
Yeah.
And most of the saucer section is all
civilians and stuff.
Yeah, it's all like apartments and stuff like that, mostly.
It's all crew quarters in there. And anytime they got into a firefight, when they fired the phasers, where did they come from? The saucer section.
Right.
So if they're gonna separate, they apparently are leaving a lot of their weapon systems behind.
Yeah.
Well, no, the secondary hull has plenty of firepower. But the thing is, you're kind of thinking in atmospheric dogfighting terms.
And
space battles.
I was realizing that about halfway through what I was saying, but I decided to just stick with it because otherwise I'd just be creating more dead space on the show.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, the maneuverability when you're talking about weapons that are essentially firing at light speed is irrelevant. You know, evasive maneuvers are kind of silly because it makes for good drama, but it doesn't make sense from an actual fighting standpoint. And when you've got two ships, you know, you've got a Galaxy class ship and a Romulan D-Derridex cruiser facing each other. Neither of those things is moving in any direction quickly other than forward. So,
yeah, yeah.
You know,
well, you know, like Scott and Tom and I talked about when we did Star Trek IV, Spock had to change all of his math because they had the weight of the water in engineering.
And I'm going to make a guess. That's
mass. And I recall, I was chewing through my car steering wheel as I was listening to that. And I was like, and then you finally got to that mass and weight are equivalent to different things. And
when you listen to this podcast, you got to know there's no scientists on this panel. So, okay. The Enterprise encounters a rift in space time while they're on a routine mission. And as they're monitoring it, a heavily damaged Enterprise C comes through, and instantly the Enterprise D undergoes a change. The timeline completely changes. The ship, the bridge goes really dark, like so dark that it's hard for them to do their job. I can't see the computer monitor.
All the panels light up. All your buttons are made of light. You can. That's the only thing you can see when the lights go that low is just your buttons.
But I also found it funny that, the bridge was darker than normal, but 10 forward was brighter than normal. All right. So Worf and Counselor Troy are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, everybody's memories have changed. They don't even, you know, they don't know that Worf was supposed to be there or Troy was supposed to be there. The whole timeline has changed because the Enterprise C, whereas they were supposed to in the original timeline, they were supposed to rescue some Klingons from an outpost. They got into a battle with the Romulans. Scott's shaking his head. I got something wrong. Go ahead.
They weren't supposed to rescue the Klingons from the Romulans. They were supposed to die trying to rescue them.
Okay. Okay.
They were going to fail. The Klingons and the Enterprise C were all to be destroyed. But it was the fact that they tried that was going to impress the Klingons.
Yeah.
We didn't know that yet.
But while they're in the middle of this battle with the Romulans, they get transported into the future. And it changes everything so that the war with the Klingons has carried on. And it's now 22 years later, and they're still at war with the Klingons. And you know, I've heard a lot of people say that this is the closest that we ever got to a mirror episode with the Next Generation. But these characters are not, this is not a mirror episode, because in the mirror universe, everybody's like an evil version of themselves. These characters are the same characters. They just had some different experiences. So there's a little bit of difference here and there. But like Geordi is still doing his job like he always does. Data is essentially the same. There's a little bit of tension, it seems like, between Riker and Picard. But other than that, it's just our same characters, but if they were in a battle. Now, if the entire last 20-some-odd years had been different, I don't know that all these characters would still be assigned on the same ship doing their same exact jobs. I think things probably would have come out differently. But like I said, it's an early 90s TV episode. You want to keep your characters where they're supposed to be.
The alternate timeline runs on mirror logic.
Yeah.
Personalities change, but positions and career choices don't.
Well, and also, do you know how this episode was written? When you see that many names on the writing credits, it often portends a very bad experience. Larry Nemechek's Trek Files show, last month, I think, it doesn't matter. He interviewed the guy that wrote the original story for Yesterday's Enterprise, and it was a little different, but you know it went through the same meat grinder process that every Star Trek script did. But essentially, they were up against it was like Thanksgiving, and all the writers were wanting to go home for Thanksgiving. And Berman was like, no, you guys are going to get this episode done over the Thanksgiving break. And so they were all writing like crazy, trying to get this thing done.
Yeah.
They were like, you know, Star Trek, you know, TNG, TOS especially, were constantly, you know, this close to disaster with getting scripts in time to get them shot. You know, they would start the season with, you know, maybe three or four, a buffer of three or four scripts that would get eaten up very quickly. And so a lot of times they were looking at, we've got to start filming in 2 weeks and we don't have a script yet. And this was one of those situations, and they had to really, you know, work 24 hours a day over the Thanksgiving break to get this script done. And that's one of the reasons when I found out about it, that I was so stunned at how good this episode is, because by all rights, it should have been a cluster F of epic proportions.
Yeah.
And, you know, some, you know, like you said, you know, there was no time to build a new Enterprise, you know, or, you know, I'm sure they would have loved to have had a, you know, probably a more Sovereign class looking ship to say, you know, this was built as a battleship 22 years ago or whatever. But, you know, they had to go with what they had. They put some steps in the bridge and turned the lights down and gave everybody a, you know, real cheap little glittery sash and stuff. But, you know, I think overall, the effect, I'm one of the pickiest bastards on this panel, and I love this episode, you know, despite some of the, you've heard me bitch about Mirror Universe and same people being in completely different situations all the time. It didn't bug me in this episode for some reason.
Yeah. When I look at the list of the writers, and two of the writers are Ira Stephen Bear and Ronald D. Moore, that smells like a rewrite to me.
Yeah.
And also the guy, and I didn't write, we've talked about him before, the guy that wrote that book that we did, you remember the behind the scenes of
Michael Piller.
Yeah. Michael Piller.
Oh, Michael Piller. Yeah.
He was a writer on this episode too, but they already had too many names
yeah.
on the written by part, so he opted to not have his name put in there.
I had an entire book just on the production of this episode in my Amazon cart, but it eventually disappeared and went out of print, out of stock before I could grab it.
Yeah. I hate it when that happens. I put this in here for when I can afford it, and then when I can afford it, it's gone.
Yeah.
Okay, so when did Guinan join the Next Generation? Was it season two or was it
season two? Season? Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Season two, episode one.
Okay.
Well, she wanted to be in from the get-go because LeVar Burton told her about the show, and she's mm-hmm. like, I want in. And Roddenberry went, we can't afford her.
Yeah, because she was a huge fan of the original series, and she loved Uhura specifically. And
yeah.
I think she'd met Nichelle at one point, didn't she? And
yeah.
Oh, probably. Yeah, probably.
And then she eventually at some point actually cornered Roddenberry and said, I'll work for Scale. Put me on the goddamn show.
Yeah. The Enterprise C. This is the first time we've seen it on screen.
I love the Ambassador class so much. I wish that had been the D.
Did they design that ship for the show, or had the Enterprise C already been kind of out there?
It was based on one of the possible designs for the D.
Okay.
It was never built. It was just a drawing. I think it would have been so much better because it was so much more of a transition between TOS days, you know, later the movie days, and TNG.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest problem with the D is not the secondary hull, although I never really liked the ovoid warp nacelles all that much, but the big bloated saucer section, and I use that goddamn term with a flaming passion, primary hull. And just saucer section sounds so stupid to me. But anyway, the first time I saw it, and I still, it looked to me like it belonged being dragged down, you know, Main Street in New York on Thanksgiving morning. just this big bloated balloon looking thing. But the Ambassador class is, you know, it's getting there, but it's sleek. I love that angled deflector dish. The angular warp nacelle pylons, I could have done with a little more flair to that. But overall, I really love the look of the Ambassador class. And I know the interior was kind of a redress of the Reliant, which was a redress of the movie Enterprise, but it still worked for me. And I love that ship so much.
This is the only time in Star Trek that we see two Enterprises at the same time.
Two different era Enterprises because we get parallels where we get 250,000 Enterprises on screen at once.
We get two.
That's all the same ship though. Yeah.
First time we get two letters at once.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two different Enterprises on screen at the same time. There were two Enterprises in Generations, but they weren't on screen together, or they weren't at the same time. And also I wanted to mention the collars on the uniforms because we get the Enterprise C, their crew comes in and they've got on the maroon monster, but there's no, like we talked about before,
they don't
have the turtleneck, but then the Enterprise D crew, their collars have all changed too.
Mm-hmm.
Their collars are up higher or yeah.
I think that the 24th century uniforms, I think the collars did go up a little bit farther, but the more noticeable change is it no longer has that dip right in the front of the neck where it comes down to meet. It was a band that went all the way around. They still had their rank pips on that, but the collar went all the way around the neck rather than like a weird cropped collar. The other changes are everyone on the Enterprise D that they got like a silverish belt with a delta on it, a delta buckle off to the side, and everyone got black cuffs at the end of their sleeves.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was carrying a sidearm. I think everybody was carrying.
Yeah, they all had phasers on them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And by that's the way,
just really quickly because he said Sherman Burris, who's commenting, said that. Prior to the airing of yesterday's Enterprise, the Enterprise C was an Alaska class ship in some printed materials. I was unaware of that. I'll have to look into that.
That's new for me too. Those black cuffs on everyone's sleeve. That's possibly the only gripe that I have with the episode.
Really?
Because at the very end of the episode, when Guinan sits down with Geordi and Tem Forward and asks him to tell her about Tasha Yar, he's wearing the wrong uniform. because he has those black cuffs on his sleeve.
I did notice that. Yeah.
I did not notice that. Good eye.
I've been for years. Anytime I watch the episode, that's all I can see in that last shot is him wearing.
Well, I mean, I've been griping for years that in all good things, Data's rank is wrong the whole time in the past. So hey.
And if I'd have noticed that when the episode originally aired, I probably would have thought, well, the timeline didn't get changed all the way back. They left something changed. Okay, so Picard and Guinan have this conversation, and now Picard trusts Guinan's intuition, but he can't base a decision of sending a ship back to the past where he knows they're going to be destroyed just based off of what she said. And she's telling him all these things are supposed to be different. She said, there's supposed to be kids on this ship. Children on the battleship? But we do meet the captain of the Enterprise C. Her crew and herself are injured in the battle. She's severely injured and gets taken to sick bay really quickly. But while the crew's working to repair the Enterprise C and tend to all their injuries, Picard has a meeting with his staff. Now, did you guys notice in when they were in sick bay and Picard went to talk to the captain, did you see that they paged
Dr. Solar?
They paged Dr. Solar.
Mm-hmm. Who didn't even appear, but yeah.
No, well, but I mean, they were just insinuating that she was still there. She was still part of the crew or whatever.
I don't think that's the only time that happened.
No, she was mentioned multiple times throughout the series. Yeah.
I can't tell you exactly when, but I'm pretty sure that was not the only time we heard mention of Dr. Solar, but of course we never saw her.
We never saw her again, but she stayed on staff for several years because Dr. Crusher was talking about her seasons later. There'd just be a mention of other members on staff.
I wanted to mention something about this. This thing kept coming up in the episode about death having meaning, right? So Riker is arguing that if they send them back to the past, then their deaths would have no meaning, even though Data argues that sacrificing themselves or their death would be considered an honorable act by the Klingons and possibly change the war. And then later on, there's a conversation with Guinan and Tasha where she says, you're supposed to be dead. Well, how did I die? So I don't know, but I know that it was an empty death and it had no meaning. I understand that Starfleet officers, they want their death to be something that people talk about. They want to die like saving people and all this kind of stuff. But death is just what happens to everybody. It's your life that's supposed to have meaning. And they keep bringing this, that death would have no meaning. Like everybody's going to die. You're supposed to live with meaning.
Yeah, but again, you're not thinking militarily. You're not thinking in a war situation. In a war situation, any minute you could just get blown up for no reason. But and your entire existence is avoiding that. But when faced with the inevitability, having a choice between just getting blown up or saving billions of lives, we're all going to die. There's no getting out of that. But if you know that your ticket's going to get punched in the next 20 minutes, regardless, but you can either just lay down and go out, or you can go out saving people. That's your choice.
Yeah, I understand that. It's just this whole thing of saying your death had no meaning. That was really a cold thing for her to say to her. I know it was an empty death. It had no meaning. Well, shit.
Well, I mean, she's not wrong. I mean, yeah. Skin of Evil, not the best episode of season one. I got to say. But, and Sherman just said that dying in the behest of Skin of Evil would be kind of worthless. Yeah.
This is my hot take. Okay. I was going to get into this a little bit later, but the time travel of this episode, that Tasha that died in Skin of Evil, that still happened. I mean, it's not like that never happened. This is a different Tasha. Mm-hmm. This is another timeline, because when she goes into the past with the Enterprise C and whatever happens to her later or whatever, when Picard and Data met Sela seasons later, they still remember Tasha and they still know that she died in Skin of Evil.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like that never happened. So this episode almost makes it look like they erased that and that Tasha died a different way, but it's not the same Tasha.
Right. No, it's very similar to how they did in the Avengers, where it makes alternate timelines and they branch off.
And they don't focus on it too much. Tasha mm-hmm. does tend to talk as if going back with the Enterprise C will erase her worthless death and replace it with a meaningful one, because she's not thinking the whole thing through and realizing, oh, well, the me that I was before the change in the timeline is still going to die the exact same way, but I'll also get to die again a couple years later as a different person, as a timeline stowaway. So I guess that's good enough. But rather than explaining, you're still going to die an empty death, but then you also get to try to die with meaning later on. So you can have both. Instead of trying to explain all that, they just make it sound like they're going to fix it and redeem her death.
But if nobody remembers it, and history doesn't record it, then does it matter? I mean, it matters to her.
It matters to her.
But didn't she still die a meaningless death?
It doesn't matter. She didn't know she was going to die a meaningless death at the hands of her.
They also had Romulan 20 freaking minutes to make this decision. We're not sitting there going, well, gee, if we do this and that and the other thing and this won't matter. Cavort class ships coming down on their asses.
Okay, can I go into, because believe it or not, the Star Trek MMO that's out actually delved into this episode quite a bit. It's not canon, but it's not technically canon, totally non-canon. They actually had Denise Crosby come back and do voice work for both Sela and Tasha. But besides the point, essentially what happens, but I've only played it as a Romulan character, so take this as you will. But what ends up happening in the MMO is that, yes, they go back to the past. Tasha goes with them. They actually end up in another timeline entirely. I know it's messed up. they end up in a slave camp or a mining facility. The crew and Tasha, mm-hmm. the surviving crew, and your character has to help break them out. And you actually get to captain the sea for a short while in a battle sequence, and it's pretty cool. And then they go back to the correct timeline. And Sela still happens and that whole thing, but it was an interesting scenario to play, and the fact that they got Denise to come back and do the voice work was pretty neat. Unfortunately, not canon.
Well, there's also the thing that, like, so Tasha goes back with them, and when they go through, the timeline changes.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those people that were in the Klingon War timeline, they all basically disappear. But the Tasha from that timeline, she still exists because she went with them. So if you think about it, really, the Enterprise could have just gone through the rift and everything would have been fixed and they could have done the mission themselves.
Well, yeah, they discussed that. Well, all right. Something I want to point out that I've been wanting to, I mean, and it's not specific to this episode solely. You know, a lot of people who are huge DS9 fans are some of the biggest complainers about the lack of canonicity of current Trek or recent Trek. Ira Stephen Baer and Ron Moore, as much as I love their work, are two of the biggest rebels against everything that Star Trek was before they started writing for it. They railed more against the rules that Roddenberry laid down than almost anyone else.
Oh yeah.
And so the fact
because they prioritize making good television over following his rules.
Exactly.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, you know, okay. There is precedent for when you're involved in a time travel event, you are insulated from the effects of that, going back to Guardian or City on the Edge of Forever, mm-hmm. where, you know, and in Yesteryear as well, where you're, right. if you're on the Guardian's planet and shit happens, it doesn't happen to you. It happens to everything else. Although in Yesteryear, it did happen to them. He's like, who the hell's that, Jim?
Yeah. Who is that, Jim? I don't know him.
So, you know, you are absolutely correct in that Star Trek does not treat time travel with any sort of consistency. But that being said, this is almost every time they do it, it's a different method. So
I know. Yeah, we have this discussion every episode.
Oh, yeah. Like, try this.
I'm saying that, you know, yes, according, you know, by, I think that Tasha should have disappeared as soon as the Enterprise C emerged on the other side, but she didn't. So then we get Sela. You know why? You know, there's a lot of things you could pick apart about this episode, but from just a sitting back and watching it and enjoying it, which I know is not something we all do. it just works so well that, okay, a lot of times, and I've said this about a lot of different shows and movies. There have been movies that I thought were terrible that I thought if they were edited a little more tightly, I wouldn't have had time to notice how terrible they were, and I would have enjoyed them. And I think that's where this episode shines, is the editing of it. It moves at such a clip that it doesn't give you enough time to go, hey, wait a minute. You know, it just keeps going. And the performances are so engaging. I would watch the hell out of an Enterprise C series. It's just a shame that they didn't do it, because I would love to see Trisha O'Neill and Christopher McDonald as Captain Garrett and Lieutenant Castillo. But of course, you know, we're all 30 years older now, so it just wouldn't work.
Yeah,
now,
he's still acting. So,
well, I'm sure they both are, but you know,
his character's dead. So
they're all in their 70s or, you know, 70, you know, so they were in their 30s then, and that was 30 years ago. So they're going to be in their 60s. You know, I would love to see a Captain Rachel Garrett series. She was such a wonderful character, and we only got a few minutes of her.
Yeah. Yeah. I've said for a long time that I would love to see a series or even a movie or something that's set in the timeline before The Next Generation, but after Star Trek. You know, sometime in the era between Star Trek VI and The Next Generation, I'd love to see something done in that era where they're wearing the Maroon Monster and all that kind of stuff. I think it would be great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the 80s or the early 90s, we almost kind of, they talked about doing a Captain Sulu film or maybe a Captain Sulu series, but it never happened.
Mm-hmm. Don't worry, wait for season 2 of Picard and we'll get some scenes that take place on the Stargazer, I'm pretty sure. So
that's another thing. There was a picture that came out where Picard is standing and talking to one of the synths. And everybody's like, well, the synth's back? And I said, I think you're seeing a flashback or you're seeing some time travel tomfoolery or something like that. But I think all the synths were shut down. We'll see. That's neither here nor there. But, okay, so also it's interesting to point out that this is the first time that Wesley ever appeared on screen in uniform, even though it was an alternate timeline.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about the Riker's death. Okay, so that was kind of gruesome, you know, his throat slashed open and everything. But the original intent was for all of the main characters to get killed gruesomely. Like, I think they were talking about Wesley getting decapitated, Data's chest getting exploded or something like that. And they wanted to show all of them having like this big death or whatever. And then because of the cost of it, and they didn't want to, you know, they didn't want to tempt the censors with some of the bloody decapitations and stuff like that. they decided against that, and they just killed Riker.
Well, so, Garrett had the freaking metal thing in her skull.
Yeah, that was pretty pretty bad. Yeah.
Nice bit of shrapnel right there in the forehead. And
yeah.
As for Riker, I mean, I really hate it when my plexiglass computer console just magically turns into rocks. And I get one of them stuck in my throat. I hate that.
Yeah. I was like, where did those rocks come from?
And it always happens. This is not every the time, only time. Yeah. Anytime that something that a console or a panel or something explodes on a starship, you find out, oh, it's a gravel pit behind there. That's where, we keep the quarry is behind the console.
I've talked about the exploding consoles in Star Trek before, but that's a design flaw in your starship. You need to make sure those consoles aren't going to explode for every time you get shot.
Well, it's like in Balance of Terror, every time the Romulan ship gets hit, plaster sifts down from the ceiling.
Yeah. I remember when Star Trek Generations came out, and it came out on video, and I saw it 3 times in the theater, but as soon as it came out on video, I went and bought a copy. Came home, and my mom and my stepdad were at home. I was like, you guys want to watch the new Star Trek movie? Sure. So I put it in. The scene where the Enterprise B gets hit with the Nexus or whatever in there, and Kirk is running through this hallway, and there's just steam coming out. And my stepdad was like, why is there steam on a starship? I was like, so that the light will bounce off of it.
It's special space plasma. Yeah.
Or as Geordi refers to it.
They use pumice for insulation.
Yeah.
As Geordi tends to refer to any steam and smoke that we see, coolant leak.
Yeah, coolant leak.
It's always coolant.
So the Enterprise C goes back, and everything changes back, and Guinan just kind of sits down and tells Geordi, hey, tell me about Tasha. And that's pretty much the end of the episode. Now, there was a novel that came out in the mid-90s or so called Q Squared by Peter David.
Mm-hmm.
And they revisit this timeline because they did they had a bunch of different timelines that kind of ended up crashing into each other in that novel. And this timeline with the Klingons and with the Klingon war going on and everything is one of those timelines. So I like to think that in a universe where you've got infinite timelines, that there is a timeline where the Enterprise C didn't go back and this timeline just kept going and those characters still existed. Maybe that's why that version of Tasha was able to still exist, because that timeline still existed. It just wasn't our primary timeline anymore. So,
you've been reading too many comic books,
man. I know.
You know that Geordi Guinan scene gave birth to one of my favorite bloopers, and it's really hard to find. The only time I ever saw it was one of the Ryan's takes.
Star Trek intakes.
Intake, that's it. Yeah. There's this dude on YouTube. He takes, you know, you can get the gag reels from the DVDs, mm-hmm. and he takes the scenes that the gag reel that different bloopers are from, and he puts them into the scene. And, you know, they're like 30-40 second long clips, and they're hilarious. But there's one which is from that scene with LeVar and Whoopi, and they're sitting there, and she's like, tell me about Tasha Yar. And he's just sitting there staring at her, and there's no more lines. So they're just staring at each other. And then finally she just gets up and says, boy, what was I talking to you about? Just maximum jumps up his
arms. All right. Now the trivia that I have for this episode, the uniforms that were used by the crew of the Enterprise C were the same ones employed by the original series movies, sans the collared undershirts and the Starfleet insignia belts. This version of the uniform would be reused by Jack Crusher in Family, 1990, and the insignia pins now doubled as comm badges, and the Type II phaser from the motion picture in The Wrath of Khan was used as a standard firearm, standard sidearm. In the new timeline, the ambient noise level in the ship was increased. The consoles and displays were made more audible. The warp engines made a dull roar sound. Intra-ship communication announcements increased. And the doors made a swoosh sound that was reminiscent of the sound used in the original TOS.
That I caught. Mm-hmm.
And the set lighting was also significantly changed and darkened.
Mm-hmm.
We also got that scene at the beginning, which I've noticed in Star Trek, especially because all of these actors had contracts where they were to appear in every episode. They were going to have Worf and Troy gone. So they had to have the scene at the beginning with Worf. Now, we saw Troy too, but she didn't really have any lines. She didn't really do anything. But we had the scene with Worf and Guinan at the beginning where he was introduced to prune juice and said, it's a warrior's drink. And then they get into this really weird conversation about Worf not wanting to date any of the women on the Enterprise because he didn't want to hurt them. And that weird...
I don't think date is really the word that you're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. But some of the women on the ship might think that you're kind of tame. Yeah, it was weird. Red and yellow alert were not used. Instead, they used battle alert. This is Denise Crosby's favorite episode. I wonder why. You got to come back and get a check. The shooting model of the Enterprise C was designed by Rick Sternbach and constructed by model maker Gregory Jine. And to depict the damage suffered during the ship's battle with the Romulans, the model was scorched with sparklers and fireworks.
Rick Sternbach has done a lot of the design work for a lot of Star Trek. Sternbach is right up there with Jeffries, in my opinion. He's just amazing.
Trish O'Neill later played Klingon Kurak in Suspicions and the Cardassian Corinus in Deep Space Nine's episode Defiant. Yesterday's Enterprise wound up needing to be filmed ahead of schedule in order to accommodate the availability of both Denise Crosby and Whoopi Goldberg. The writers initially expressed concern that putting a rush on finishing the script would result in a poor or ineffective quality of story. This is listed as one of the 10 essential episodes of TNG in the 2008 reference book Star Trek 101. Cortrazine, in fact, an overdose of cortrazine is what drove Dr. McCoy mad in City on the Edge of Forever. By the time of TNG, this has been improved and is now tricortrazine, and apparently without any fear of overdoses.
We were seeing that used in, at least Shades of Grey. I don't know if it was being used before that.
Yeah, I've heard it mentioned. I didn't catch it in this one, but Sherman also points out that Sternbach designed the Vorchok class Klingon battlecruiser.
Oh, okay. Riker mentions battling and traveling the Archer IV. Years later, Captain Jonathan Archer was a central character on the Enterprise. It's unknown if this is a coincidence. And in an early draft of the script for this episode, the Klingon commander who demands the Enterprise's surrender during the battle was going to be Worf. That would have been kind of cool if it had been Worf. Mm-hmm. And there was an original script, or not a script, it was like an original story idea where it was supposed to be Ambassador Sarek, and Mark Leonard was supposed to come back, and he was going to use the Guardian of Forever to replace Surak, and going to change the timeline, and that's how they were going to do it, and then they decided not to go that route.
I'm glad, because that would have been weird.
It would have been weird, but
stretch to get it.
Okay, so who wants to give their thoughts on Sela? We've kind of beat around the bush a little bit, but we already know somebody's
opinion.
Well, because so Tasha went back, she survived the battle that they had, and she was taken prisoner by a Romulan that kind of fancied her, I guess, and ended up impregnating her. Yeah, impregnating her.
The word you're looking for is rape.
Yeah, right. which I mean, I'm watching this, I'm like, she was raised with rape gangs all around her. She had to dodge being raped her whole childhood, and then you're going to make it her life ends by being raped and impregnated, and then her baby is the one that ends up getting her killed because she's on the run and she's got the baby with her, and the baby cries out and she ends up getting killed. And
you know, I have mellowed a bit on the Sela thing over the years. You know, the more I learned about why Denise Crosby left the show, which was, you know, a little less voluntary than, you know, we thought at the time. We didn't realize what a douchebag Berman was, and you know, and all that stuff. And this episode was a great way to bring her back. And she is very proud of the fact that she came up with the idea for Sela. And, you know, good on her. You know, it got her back in the show. It's a fairly popular character. You know, got her working, which, you know, I think that she was very poorly used by Star Trek and deserves whatever she can get. I just think the whole Sela storyline is so flawed. And not even just from the, you know, whether or not Tasha should have been able to go back or not. I don't care about that. I've always had a problem with the same actor playing their descendant.
Yeah.
You know, that's always kind of bugged me in any, you know, to Paul's ancestor being played by Jolene Blaylock, Janeway's ancestor being played by Kate Mulgrew. That, you know, I know it's a storied tradition in television. I've just never cared for it. And then on top of it all, Sela was just so utterly incompetent at anything she tried to do that it was just, it wasn't. Okay, Sherman says without Sela, unification would have been much less interesting. I disagree. I think you could take Sela out of that, put any other Romulan in there.
Yeah, it could have been anybody.
And it wouldn't, because all of the scenes, you know, with, oh my God, this is, how can you be Tasha? And there was that meeting with Picard. And then there was absolutely no consequence from that whatsoever.
Yeah.
So I don't think the Sela character was, I don't hate it as much as I used to. You know, for the reasons I just said, but ultimately, Sela could be excised from Star Trek without making a even the slightest change to anything.
And I personally, I don't think that's so much a consequence or result of her being a bad character or her not being used properly. When I suppose you can say that, yes, it is a result of her not being used properly, but more to the point, of her being underused. I liked the concept of it. When we get to the end of... Now, I can't remember. Does she show her face at the end of Redemption Part 1? Is that where it is?
Yes. Was the kind of situation.
Never discount Jean-Luc Picard.
Yeah, he is human. Humans have a way of showing up when you least expect them. End season 3. Done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. That's end season 4. Season 3 ended with Best of Both Worlds. That's my bad. So between Yesterday's Enterprise and Redemption Part 1, which is the end of season 4. So in that season and a half, we did see her one other time, kind of, sort of. And that was in the episode... I think Mind's Eye, is that what it was? Geordi gets kidnapped by the Romulans and brainwashed.
I think so, yeah. She was in the shadows.
Yeah. We never saw her face. I think we heard her voice once, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But they were keeping that a real shadowy character, what's going on in the shadows. At the end of Redemption, we see her face. That's really fascinating, and some people had already started putting together the pieces on how that could be. And then season 5 premiere, Redemption Part 2, they prove us right, and they explain this is how this character came to be. And, yeah, her plan didn't work because Data foiled her. Okay, you know, bad guys lose sometimes. Doesn't necessarily mean she's incompetent. She tried a plan, it didn't work. They could have, from that point forward, they could have made her a serious, formidable, recurring Romulan villain. They brought her back one time for Unification Part 1 and 2 with a bad plan and a poorly written turn as this returning villain, and they never tried it again.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their fault. They could have done a lot with this character if they had put in the effort and if they had done it right. Then she could have been a serious Romulan antagonist recurring throughout multiple seasons. They could have done a lot with the character. They could have even, like some people had said, they wanted to do this. They could have brought her back for Nemesis and have her be a factor in that, but they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
She leaves a bad taste in our mouth as a not so great villain because they only tried to use her a few times, and when they tried, it wasn't pulled off very well. And that's their fault. It's not her fault. It's not the character's fault. It's the writer's fault.
Yeah.
They could have done better, and they should have.
Yeah. And again, referring once again to the Star Trek MMO, she has a bigger part in that. And actually, because the MMO takes place about 2 or 3 years after Romulus blows up. So it's in that time. So with all the Romulans scattered throughout the galaxy, she becomes the new Empress.
Mm-hmm.
She's the quote-unquote savior of the Romulans because she was the only one who had any type of authority because most of the other high-ranking Romulans got killed when the planet blew up.
And then even they, you know, write her as kind of a poor villain because she thinks, oh, see, I'm super smart. I'm going to walk away with control of all of the Romulans that are left in the galaxy because I'm going to team up with the Iconians and I'm still going to come out on top in the end. No,
it didn't happen.
The Iconians ruled the galaxy thousands of years ago. They walked right over her.
I want to take issue with one thing you said. You said she wasn't a bad character. She was just written that way. That's all the character is words on a piece of paper. I'm not saying that Denise Crosby played her badly, but they wrote her as incompetent. I mean, look at Tomalak, okay? We only saw Andreas Katsoulis as Tomalak a few times. And he was kind of goofy too, but he was still menacing and he was still well written. And you remember him, you think he was there a whole lot more than he was. Whereas with Sela, it's almost the opposite. You're like, oh, she was really in 4 episodes? Wow. I thought it was only like 1 or 2. I don't think they ever took her seriously. They just kind of went, oh, we'll make her kind of the goofy.
Well, she was initially brought in for shock factor, right? Yeah. And then I don't think they had a direction of where to really go with her after that.
Mm. Now, Rick, I take your point, and it's a point well made in that when I say we have Mandy in the chat that just jumped in with maybe it's better to say the idea of her wasn't bad, which is exactly where I was going with this. Now, okay, Rick,
I will grant you.
You said that I had said it wasn't a bad character, but it was bad writing, and you say that's what the character is. And I should refine my statement to say that it's more the potential of the character was not bad.
Mm-hmm.
The character had potential. They could have made it a good character, but they didn't capitalize on it. And that was the problem.
Yeah. And I 100% agree with you there.
Scott, you know who Mark Bernard is, right? From Fat Man Beyond.
Oh, Mark Bernard.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to tag him. When I post this episode on Twitter, I'm going to tag him because he's a writer on season 2 of Picard. And I'm going to say, Mark, get Denise Crosby on Picard and fix it. fix her character.
I have to admit, I don't listen to Fat Man Beyond anymore. It fell off of my subscription list.
Every episode's like 3 hours, so
nothing. Yeah, it's not like it's anything personal against the hosts. It's just I kind of shifted away from the Kevin Smith style of podcasting, which is a lot of talk, and you get a few good moments in there, but you got to get through a lot of yammer, which has varying degrees of quality. But one thing that was always great about Fat Man Beyond is when they would talk about a series or a franchise or a property, and Bernardin would just out of nowhere, out of the clear blue sky, he would pull out an idea of this is a way that this particular thing could be improved. And he would just toss it off on the spur of the moment, completely extemporaneous. You could try this and that would make it better. And he's always right.
Yeah.
That guy is brilliant.
He was in the Deep Space Nine documentary. He was one of the talking heads that they interviewed. Yeah,
sure was.
So that's pretty much all I've got. Does anybody want to add anything before I start closing up?
I thought that the scene between the second scene, I think it was, between Picard and Guinan in this episode in the observation lounge, where he calls her in and he starts the scene with, I need more.
Yeah.
That entire back and forth between them is brilliant. It is a wonderfully written and brilliantly performed scene. it's tight, it's taut. There's tension, there's drama. It's everything you want in a Star Trek episode, and it's right there in that scene. It's my favorite part of the episode.
I like when Tasha goes to Picard and says, "I'm not supposed to be here." He says, "What did she say to you?"
Yeah.
All right. Before we go, I want to mention our Patreon page. It was it went live a couple weeks ago, and I've uploaded the first episode that we made specifically for our patrons, where we talked about Kingdom of the Spiders. I'm also going to be releasing the episodes of this show and of that Superfan Talk podcast. When I finish editing the episode, I'll post it to Patreon days before I'll post it to the rest of our listeners. So if you want early access to our episodes, they'll be on there as soon as I finish editing. If you're
lots more time to hate what I said.
the regular episodes, that Star Trek podcast will be coming out on Tuesdays, and that Super Fan Talk podcast will be coming out on Thursdays. So other than that, you'll be able to see them on Patreon as soon as they're done. So for a donation of $3 a month, you get access to all of the bonus content. And then, you know, for a little bit more, you can get access to our Slack discussions. You can be invited to be on the show. You'll be listed as a producer of the show. By the way, this episode is produced by Tom Corcoran, Bulent Bingal, and Brandon Ushio. So to find out
those guys,
to find out more, go to patreon.com/infinitepotato. And Rick, thank you very much for being here tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You want to tell everybody where they can find you?
Yeah. you can find out me there. Right here on the Infinite Potato Alliance with Starbase 66 and Open the Iris, our Stargate SG-1 watch-along show. And very soon I'll be taking the reins of, what the hell? Prime Directive. I even helped come up with the name of that show. I can't remember. And I'm only drinking this. I'm sober.
Pro tip. Learn the name of the show before you start hosting the show.
Especially when you start reaching out to have people on the show, you might want to know the name of it.
I might. Right.
All right. Jen, thank you for being here.
Yeah. Thank you for having me as always.
All right. And Scott, thank you.
Always a pleasure. It's fun times.
You want to plug your pluggables there, Scott?
But I suppose. I mean, if you insist, I don't really have to, I guess. Yeah, if anyone has any sort of enjoyment in listening to me blather, you can hear me right here on this show, oftentimes on that Super Fan Talk podcast, occasionally on Captain Game Show. I have one more episode of The Prime Direction, which some of you may have heard of in the past 2 minutes. Coming up on this very network, it has been recorded. The interview has been edited. All that is left is to record the framing segments at the beginning and the end. With a particular guest for that portion, as we do a little handing off of the torch, that will be recorded very soon, and that final episode of mine will be coming out in short order, I would think. I think it's quite possible to have it out before May, so we'll see. And then after that, I am going to start preliminary planning on what could very possibly be a brand new podcast from me. Sneak preview for folks. The working title is "I'd Watch That for a Dollar." Stay tuned to the Infinite Potato Alliance for more on that. And if you don't want to listen to me, you just want to see stuff that I do, then you can check out some of my graphic artwork online, either on Twitter at Planet Rise, right there in my screen name for those of us watching on Facebook, or you can visit my website www.planetrisecreative.com, always available for commissions. So if you have art needs, a logo, a banner, a poster, a card, anything of that sort, reach out. We'll think of something.
Holiday snaps could be taken on holiday. Blink, wink, nudge, nudge. All right, really quick, before we sign off, I'm gonna put this out there on a couple of times. Anyone within the sound of my voice, an actual, honest-to-God, working scientist who wants to be on a podcast, contact me.
Okay. All right. That's going to do it for this episode. Make sure you join us next time as we continue our time travel retrospective with the TNG episode Captain's Holiday. Until then, let's make sure history never forgets the name Enterprise.